Hey, this is Russell, and I work at the video store, the place that we can all go to every week when it's movie night. On days like today, our interesting customers pop in to rent something, and we go through the films that they've loved across their life. All right, let's do it. Let's open up the shop. Top of the morning.
Hey, Russ.
How are you, my G-Force?
Right, dude, how are you?
I'm good, man. The day has finally arrived.
Yes.
We have been sitting with this episode for a very long time.
Yeah.
Welcome to the video store. Thank you for wandering in. We have such lovely stuff here on our shelves in the video store, including the very interesting, very odd, very delightful Mickey 17, which is in cinemas around the world.
Yes.
And it is based on a book called Mickey 7. Mm-hmm. And the author of that book, Edward Ashton, is going to pop in to rent something today. So yes, it's all very exciting. We have been expecting and hearing about this film for a very long time.
Yeah.
And we don't have to get too much into it, but it was a film that was postponed and delayed, the biggest of which was for the actors' strikes. And also the perfection of Bong Joon-ho, who is the celebrated Korean filmmaker who is at the helm of this film.
Yes.
And based on that, I knew that it was based on a book. I was able to pick up a copy of it because I was very excited to read it.
Yeah.
And this lovely moment happened at the beginning of last year where I was actually on a beach.
Oh, yeah.
I finished reading the book on a beach on a family holiday. And I Googled Edward Ashton just to find out more about him and perhaps see. And I realized that he has a website like any author does.
Yeah.
And he's got a contact page. And so I just thought, fuck it.
Yeah, take a swing.
Take a swing. And then I also realized that through Instagram that, you know, he was still an author that was still very much establishing himself.
Yeah.
You know, not this sort of huge author. And so perhaps he's that much more approachable. And of course he was. He was very cool to respond.
Nice.
We set up this meeting and we were able to have this chat. And so the conversation that you're going to hear is very much us traveling through a time portal here. Back to May of 2024.
Yep.
That's when we had this chat. So a lot of the details of Mickey 17 were still being announced. I think literally during the chat, I realized that more had been sort of given and released. So put yourself in that space. I just was so fascinated to meet him. I thought it was such an interesting time to capture him because now, literally this weekend, this past weekend, is such a huge weekend for him.
Yeah.
Like the day arrived where, you know, this film's coming out.
Finally.
And then I want you and I to chat about it.
Cool.
So I think let's waste no more time.
Yes.
I think let's have Edward pop in. Mm. Well, firstly, let's go through this time. This time portal where he will pop in. But then for those who are coming to us for the first time, perhaps, if you've come through Edward, we are going to have ourselves a little chat here behind the counter after this conversation where I want to talk to you a little bit more about Mickey 17.
Yes.
There's a couple of other things I actually watched this weekend, which I want to tell you about.
Nice.
Graham, and anyone who's browsing the shelves, listening in on our conversation. But then, because we need to get into the nitty-gritties a bit of the book and the film and the interesting ways in which they do differ, we will have a couple of spoilers. So what we'll do, if you're cool with it, Graham, is we'll lock up shop. We'll go outside into what we call the spoiler alley.
Yes.
Where you and I will chat a little bit more about some of the nitty-gritties because I want to talk about that stuff too.
Definitely.
Okay. All right. Let's get into it.
Cool.
All right. This is Edward Ashton popping in to rent something. Hi there. Welcome to the video store.
Thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity.
I had the lovely pleasure of reading your book, Mickey 7, and I'm so excited to chat to you because here at the Bioscope, our cinema, we obviously can see what films are going to be released. And at the start of the year, we upgraded so that we were able to see and be able to screen these bigger studio films. And I must say, Mickey 17 was one that I was very excited about. And so I rushed out and bought the book and really enjoyed reading it. We'll talk more about it, but you are on the cusp of what is a very exciting time because the film is on its way. Perhaps the best way to start is how did this all come about for you? When did you hear about how did the optioning of the film work?
This was actually a very unusual sort of process from what I understand. The usual way that this works is that a book is published, it becomes a bestseller, people get excited about it, studio decides to pick it up, and then things go from there. That's not what happened with this book. So I wrote this book. I turned it into my agent in December of 2019.
Okay.
And so he took it out to shop it around at that time. And before we had received an offer of publication, we received notice that Warner Brothers was interested in optioning the book. So we got the option offered before we even had a publisher for the book. You know, it was just sort of a PDF manuscript that my agent had been shopping around. And obviously that was really helpful to my agent when he's selling the book to publishers to say, we already have an option offer from Warner Brothers for this book. And I'm sure that was very helpful in his negotiations with the publishers when we got the publication contracts in place. But yeah, the option was signed in, I believe, January of 2020. So just a few weeks after I turned in the manuscript to my agent.
Do you have any idea how it managed to get to the right person, or how that script even got to them?
My agent is some sort of dark wizard. Is the only assumption that I've been able to make. He got the manuscript in the hands of the folks at Plan B Productions, which is Brad Pitt's production company, okay, with Jeremy Kleiner and Dee Dee Gardner. And they read it and it spoke to them for whatever reason. It spoke to them. I'm not going to question that at all.
No, sure.
They had just begun the relationship with Warner Brothers. So they apparently took it to Warner Brothers and said, this is something that we want as our, I believe it was their first project working directly with Warner Brothers. And Warner Brothers said, okay. They provided the funding and, you know, things went forward from there.
And out of all the directors one could wish for, you've got one of the best filmmakers you could ask for to be attached, Bong Joon-ho. And I think, yeah, just how do you think that even came about?
That's the part that leads me to wonder whether, in fact, I might actually be in an ICU right now on a heavy morphine drip and they're just getting ready to pull. Because that's so incredibly implausible. You know, Bong Joon-ho, 2019, wins 7 Oscars for Parasite. He's the hottest director in the world. People are besieging him with offers for what his next project should be. Please do this, do this, do this. He's getting, you know, hundreds of offers a month. And why don't you look at this manuscript? Why don't you look at this script? And out of that giant pile of dross, you know, he picks out my book and says, no, this is it. This is the one I'm going to do.
It's so,
and
it's,
I am
so
not
amazing.
Stephen King. Let's be very clear about that. I am not, you know, an incredibly famous celebrity author that would make sense for. So yeah, he did have a pre-existing relationship with Plan B because they produced Okja with
him.
So there was that connection there, which is how they were able to reach out to him. But as far as why he decided to move forward with the project, again, obviously the book spoke to him, but as to why that should have occurred, it's an absolute mystery to me.
But it's so exciting. And how do you feel now? Because as you said, you have written stuff. It sounds like you lecture, which I want to get into. And so you obviously are doing lots of incredible stuff with your life. But how do you feel in this time now? Because this feels like this could be some kind of calm before a storm for you. Because obviously the other thing to mention is that the film was going to come out in March, but has since been put out. So how are you feeling before this could become a household name?
I mean, I've had a lot of time to get used to the idea. As I said, I've been sitting with this for 4 years now. And it's only come into the public consciousness fairly recently, I think. But this has been a process. It's been grinding very slowly. And it's been a sort of a step by step, you know, it's sort of like as you're walking slowly into very cold water, the first bite is really difficult. And then it starts to get routine as the water creeps up your body, maybe. So that the big moment for me was when I was sitting with my wife at the breakfast table, probably 3 years ago now, and my phone dinged, and it was a text from my agent, and it was just a link that said, click on this. And of course, I immediately thought, this is a phishing attack. Obviously, I'm not an idiot. I'm not going to click on this.
Yeah.
I thought about it. He's my agent. You know, I don't think his account got hacked. So I went ahead and clicked on it. And it was a link Deadline article saying that Bong Joon-ho had signed on to the project and was going to be directing. And my wife looked at me and immediately said, oh, my God, who died? Because she saw my face just drop. No, this is good. This is not a bad thing. That's when it really became clear to me that this was going to move forward.
Yeah.
Everything on either side of that has just been sort of very incremental. So there hasn't been that one big shocking moment like that one was.
Yeah. When did the shooting take place? And did you have a chance to meet anyone involved? How does it work? Because I'd imagine, you know, obviously there is such an important part, which is your text, but then I think you also sort of have to give a bit over, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. When you sign a development contract like this, you are handing full control of your baby over to someone else. I had no control over the development of the script. That was entirely Bong's work, putting the script together and sort of conceiving how the film was going to go. The shooting occurred in the fall of 2022. It started in September, and I think they wrapped in December of 2022. It was all done at Leavesden Studios outside London. They did fly me in for a few days to observe some of the filming and meet the crew. I got to spend some time with director Bong. I got to meet Robert Pattinson and some of the other folks on the cast. They're doing the film. I don't know if this was publicized very much, but it's all being done with practical sets. They're using
great.
Very little CGI. So they actually built all this stuff. These things that I sort of dreamed up, they built them life size, and I crawl around through them and like see these things that I had imagined being brought into the physical world. And that was a very surreal experience. It was really that was sort of one of those peak moments in my life that I'm going to remember forever.
That's so great. So the film is Mickey 17. So it's slightly different from Mickey 7. So I'd imagine it's the same concept, but let's talk about what the film, what the story is about. Because I also want to be careful what we can say and what we can talk about. And perhaps I'd be curious to know whether you know how much the film could be different. But we are in the far future where we are colonizing other planets, and we are taking spaceships and journeys over to other planets that are habitable. And in the crew on this particular planet, we have Mickey, who is an expendable. So he is someone who can be brought in to do the worst stuff that could probably involve him dying. And he can be cloned. I see on the IMDb, he's referred to as a robot, which I thought was interesting. But it's almost like a sort of a clone, right?
Yeah, that's not it's definitely not. He's definitely not a robot. And I'm gonna preface this by saying I have read the script. I know what the differences are between the book and the film. However, I also signed an NDA, which
was extremely scary.
you know, I know some of the cast members have talked about the NDAs that they signed about how they can sort of, you know, if they reveal anything about the film, they've agreed that they can be chopped up and sold for dog food or something. That's basically the level of NDA that they had us all sign. So I'm not going to say anything that is not publicly available knowledge here.
Of course, of course. Oh, sorry, I was just going to say, so we've got this very interesting type of character, which is this expendable. So he's died many times, and here we are at his seventh incarnation in this inhospitable planet as he sort of goes about in chaos, or some forms of interesting stuff happens. But that's just basic sort of setting up. What I wanted to perhaps chat about just to start is I saw a lovely interview with you when you spoke about a particular paradox, right? Or it's a, I forget the correct term, but it was about what you're playing on and what this book addresses, which is this idea of if you were to have replicated yourself, are you the same person? And you used Star Trek, the Star Trek sort of beam me up teleporting as a great example of how preposterous that really is as a thing. If you think about it, how do you completely disappear someplace and you know, in all your form reappear somewhere else? What was that paradox that you mentioned?
Yeah, so that's sort of the central philosophical question of the book. It's referred to as the teletransport paradox, and this is something that was first formulated in 1755.
Jesus, so this early is something as that, hey?
Philosophers have been, yeah. So now the idea when it was first formulated, the way the question was posed was if I could transport my soul into a perfect replica of my earthly form, would that new form be me, or would this be another? That's the original formulation of the question. And that is, this is something that many philosophers have chewed over for the last several hundred years. And the central question is, are we our memories, or are we something more than that? Is there something more to us than just a collection of memories and experiences?
Yeah.
If there's nothing more to us than just this, our sort of accumulated experiences, then this recreated person, if we could, you know, print a new body out for us, and or do what Ray Kurzweil proposes to do, right? Ray Kurzweil at Google is very excited about the idea of uploading his consciousness into a computer, and he believes that will be a form of immortality. If you believe that all we are is this collection of memories and experiences, then he's right. That is immortality. If you believe that there's something more to us to that, if there is some singular I that only exists sort of behind my eyes, then that's not immortality. That's just another person walking around with my bank code.
Yeah.
And who's able to fool other people into thinking that he's me. And which one of those is true is the central question of Mickey's life in this book. The way he formulates the question is, imagine, and this is something I've actually thought about since I was a kid. One of the reasons that I wrote this book is because this is something that's sort of bothered me since I was little. Imagine that when you go to sleep at night, you don't just go to sleep, you die. And when you wake up in the morning, it's a completely different person waking up in your bed. He has all your memories, he has all your experiences, but he's not you. And he will in turn die when he goes to sleep at night, and a new person will take his place. Is there any way you can prove to me that that is not exactly what happens? Is there any way you can prove to me that that is not true?
That's wild. So that came to you so young, and you were you were grappling with that as a kid. That's amazing, and I love how that resulted in you making this story. I love the fact that he, as this expendable, is treated so badly and is a freak, and people. People don't want to hang out with him. They don't want to have anything to do with him. He's an abomination. I thought that was quite an interesting part to his character. Another thing that I also really loved, which I just wanted to mention, was how, you know, although we're in this far future where everything's a bit fantastical, you've rooted it in quite a lot of realism. And I just wanted to say I admired you talking about things like the failed colonies and how things didn't work and how practically it is so expensive for this kind of future colonizers to colonize. You know, we've watched so many science fiction films where it just happens, right? They just beam across the universe and go to all these different worlds. But in your book, you talk about how expensive it is and how once you're there, you can't come back, not in your lifetime. So it felt quite real, which I thought was really cool.
Well, in addition to being a writer, I am a working scientist. So,
yes, and so I wanted to get into that.
Grounding things in actual known physics is important to me. So I did want to bring in those sort of elements of realism. I read a lot of science fiction. I'm happy to read stories where, as you say, people are just sort of magically transported from place to place. It makes the story flow better in a lot of cases, but for myself, I prefer, for the most part, to try to ground things a little more in things that we understand as in terms of physical principles.
Yeah, it's been exciting to see the cast being announced, and me putting some faces to the imagination I had. It's interesting that Mark Ruffalo is going to be the Marshal.
Yeah, I think he did, everything I've read in terms of the test screenings that he's done an absolutely fantastic job with the character. Obviously, he seems to have taken a little different direction than the way I laid it out in the book. But again, that's how films work, right?
Sure. They're
going to interpret things in their own way.
How did you imagine Mickey? Because unfortunately, when I was reading the book, every now and again, I did picture Robert Pattinson, obviously because I knew that information before I was reading the book. But how did it change? Like, what was your original perception of Mickey?
Mickey to me is sort of an everyman. Robert Pattinson, you know, people have asked me, do you feel like he was a good choice to cast? And I mean, he's a fantastic actor. He has a huge fan base. I think he was a great choice for the film. He's a little prettier than I imagined Mickey being. I imagined Mickey being more of an average, you know, an average sort of, he's not particularly tall. He's not particularly strong. Mm. He's not one of these chiseled jaw action hero types. He's someone who could stand in for any of us.
Yeah.
And that's how I wanted the reader to identify with him.
Yeah. And Toni Collette. I saw that now because when I think this cast has actually only been announced very recently, because while I was reading the book, which was only a few weeks ago, I hadn't seen who was who. Toni Collette's going to be Gwen. Was she the person who trained him before he left? Or she was the person who signed him up? Who was Gwen? Or is that a different character?
Gwen is the person who interviews him for the job. So there's one,
that's right.
What I thought was one of the most fun scenes in the book, where he's interviewing for the job, and Gwen is basically trying to dissuade him from taking the job, trying to convince him that this is, without so much, you know, without coming right out and saying it to him, this is a really, really bad idea and you don't want to do this. And for reasons of his own, of course, he's not able to be dissuaded. He really needs this. And at the end, she just sort of throws up her hands and says, okay, well, I guess welcome aboard. Good luck. So that was a really fun scene to write.
Yeah. No one ever applied. They would have to have taken it from, you know, taken the job from, you know, convicts or something. But he was the one person who applied, which I thought was amazing. What we like to do here at the Video Store is we like to take a quick journey through your life as a way of establishing what films have come to you across your life. Because we believe that these films have helped make who you are today. And I think we've established now at this point this exciting time as we are waiting for the release of the film. So we kind of know where you are now. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in a small town in West Virginia, a very rural part of Appalachia, coal mining area. Former way, one of these places that was sort of formerly very wealthy, and sort of the coal company took everything they could out of the ground, took the money with them, and went elsewhere and left the people behind. And that's essentially where I grew up.
Okay. And do you have any early film memories? Films that came to you at a particular time? This kind of just at the start of school, perhaps while you were still in that town. This is what we call the puppy love film here at the Video Store.
Yeah, Yeah, I mean, in terms of science fiction, I think that the first one that really bit for me was probably Alien. It's arguable how much Alien really is about science fiction. Alien is basically a haunted house story in outer space.
Yeah, that's a good point.
It was extremely visceral for me watching that film. The idea of this thing, and particularly the portion of the film where the monster is sort of creeping through the air ducts and they don't know where it is.
Mm.
And then there's one particular scene where Ripley comes across Captain Dallas and he's sort of tied up in a web. He's already got the alien sort of spores in his stomach and he just looks at her and he says, "Kill me."
Yeah.
And that, for whatever, I don't know how old I was. I probably was 12, 13 years old. And that just really sort of grabbed me, that idea of, because that was the first time I'd really been introduced, which is, you know, it's sort of a trope that you see in films and books a lot. The idea that, things are so bad, I really would rather you just set me on fire at this point. Wow. That really, that was very visceral for me.
Yeah. And it's nice to hear that in Mickey 17, they are going to be that many practical effects, because when you watch those films from the 80s, also thinking of the John Carpenter body horror stuff, like The Thing, the practical effects just give you such, as you said, visceral. It's a visceral reaction, which just makes such a difference. So that's quite exciting that they did so much practically. Over onto high school, I know in America you've got your middle school and then high school, hey? But around 16, 17, 18, we've got something called The High School Crush. And this is perhaps a film that's come to you that's perhaps a bit more dangerous or a bit more adult. Was there any film that you can think of that could perhaps epitomize your high school era?
When I was that age, 17, 18, 19 years old, I, with one of my friends, got into the habit of seeking out really terrible films.
Okay.
We would go and watch and be literally the only people in the theater watching these movies before they crashed and burned. I'm talking about things like Tank Girl. I don't know if you remember Tank Girl.
We've actually done that at the Bioscope as a cheesy movie night.
Yeah. Or it's sort of like Ice Cube dressed up in a kangaroo costume and, those sorts of films. So.
It's so wild. Okay. All right. So Tank Girl. What other ones can come to mind?
I believe I was one of maybe three people in the world who actually went to see Ishtar in the theater.
Which one? Sorry,
that was Ishtar.
What's that?
You may not. Ishtar was a Dustin Hoffman film. It was a huge budget film. Okay. I believe still one of the biggest busts in the history of Hollywood. It absolutely crashed and burned.
What was it about?
But I saw it. So,
what was it about?
Yeah. It was about Dustin Hoffman and one of his friends. Somehow they wound up in the desert in like Saudi Arabia, wandering through the desert on a camel. Okay. It was just, I'm struggling to convey the plot because there was no plot. That was part of the problem.
Okay.
Someone had the idea of, hey, Dustin Hoffman is very popular. If we put him on a camel in Saudi Arabia, that would be funny. Let's just do that. And then they never thought beyond that to maybe we should actually write a script with plot and characters and so forth.
Was it trying to take itself seriously?
No, it was supposed to be a comedy.
Okay.
It was supposed to be a comedy.
Okay.
It wasn't funny. It wasn't anything. It was, as I said, it was an absolute epic failure.
But at this point, you're starting to wonder about mortality and you're starting to anxiously go to sleep, hey? Have some of those thoughts made their way in at this point?
I mean, I was a pretty dark kid. I was wondering about mortality way younger than I should have been wondering about mortality. I have a benign cardiac arrhythmia,
okay,
which first surfaced when I was about 12 years old, and I didn't tell anyone about it. One of my heroes was a basketball player named Hank Gathers who died abruptly of a cardiac arrhythmia on the basketball court. I was a basketball player also. I just assumed that was going to happen to me. From 12 to probably 24, 25, I just basically assumed that every time I stepped on a basketball court, there was a fair chance I was going to die. And the thought that I would live to be 25 years old just never crossed my mind.
Hectic.
And so I did a lot of really, like, I used to do free solo rock climbing. No ropes, no equipment, because if I die, I'm going to die anyway. So what's the point of worrying about it? And that actually lasted up until the point that I got married and my wife became pregnant with our first child. And I suddenly realized I have to live. I can't actually die. And so I went to a cardiologist and he checked me over and he said, actually, you're fine. There's nothing. This is no problem at all. You're totally fine. And then I had this moment of horror that I had kind of been playing with my life for all these years for no actual reason. But I probably contemplated mortality more than most people do at a very young age.
That's amazing, because that's what the whole book is premised over. This idea that, you know, Mickey's able to live forever because he can just be reborn. He comes out of the tank. And I love the idea of there being this thing called the tank funk, where for a couple of days, you know, he wasn't just going to pop out and exist in society. When this new version of him was made, there was going to be days where he was very hungry and drowsy. But that was the thing, is that he could live forever, and he was immortal in that sense. So he could take those risks. And it's amazing that you embodied a lot of that for a portion of your life.
I mean, I think most authors write their own neuroses. That's what we do. We write our own fears. If you read something in a book that's put forward as a sort of a horror scene, that's probably something that particular author is particularly frightened of. Mm. When you see, any kind of dramatic scene or something, that's usually the author writing some of his own demons or her own demons out onto the page.
Yeah.
I think that's how most of us operate.
No, and it's authentic. It's true to you. And then when did we start writing?
I published my first professional piece in 1989. So I've been at this for a while.
Yeah. Then after high school, we've got our next film, which is the It's Getting Serious film, which is the 20s. As you are studying, starting your career, where did you then go on to study?
I received my bachelor's degree from Loyola University, which is in Baltimore, Maryland. There's four of them, but the one I went to is in Baltimore, Maryland. I got my PhD from the University of Rochester in Rochester, New York.
Okay, so at that point, we've moved now East Coast, New York. And that's kind of where you are now, hey? You're upstate New York when you're talking to me, eh?
I'm still in the Rochester area, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've been here for quite a while now. I guess I've settled. I'm a native.
It's a beautiful part of the world. I managed to spend, about a week in Ithaca. I know upstate New York's huge. How far away is that?
Yeah.
Is that close?
That's about an hour and a half from here.
Yeah, the Finger Lakes, right? Is that the right term for those lakes?
Yep, it's right down the road.
It's so beautiful. And we stayed in this bed and breakfast that was run by this very, for lack of a better term, sort of like hippie woman. And we had a sort of a family, sort of what we would call a braai, I guess a barbecue, with friends and family came, and you know, we were just these tourists from South Africa, and it was just so welcoming, and so it was such a lovely, beautiful part of the world.
It is very pretty. I live in the middle of the forest up here. I live in the middle of a 100-acre nature preserve. So I really appreciate the natural world that we have here. It's something that I never saw when I lived in Baltimore. I lived in Washington, D.C. for years, and you know, that this sort of natural world was something I really missed when I was living in the middle of a big city.
Yeah, and I'm sure you thought about that when you were writing Mickey 7, because a lot of it talks about how inhospitable this planet is that they're on, this like icy planet. And I'm sure, you know, that's a huge contrast to the beautiful nature that was around you, right?
I mean, we are on the Canadian border. So, you know, when I was writing those scenes, I was probably looking out the window at a 4-foot drift of snow piled up against the house. I mean, it does, we do get 120 or 30 inches of snow a year here. So that those scenes are also written from heart for me.
Okay. We've got our last film, which is the film you could settle down with, which is, you know, one of the greatest for you across your life. Is there one or two that you think could be a film you could marry?
I'm going to be very normie here and probably disappointing. My favorite film of all time is The Princess Bride, and I'm sure that's true for many people my age bracket. I've watched it a million times. I went to see it at the Kodak Theater when Cary Elwes came to do a talk beforehand, and got to hear him talk about the filming. And I feel like it's a perfect movie. It really has every single thing. Many people
say that. Yeah. Something you watch with your kids, perhaps?
My kids have watched it also many times. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that's lovely. What's next for you? There's more books that are in the Mickey 7 series, which is great. Are you enjoying expanding the universe?
There is a sequel. It's called Antimatter Blues. That came out, I guess, a year and a half ago. The next book that I put out, actually was just released about a month ago, is called Mal Goes to War. That book is not related to Mickey. That's a standalone novel, completely different setting, completely different world, different universe. My next book after that, which has been turned into my publisher, it's in the production chain. It's coming out in early February of next year. Again, it's a standalone novel, no relation to either of those, and not, no relation to Mal Goes to War or to the Mickey universe. I have pitched a third Mickey book to my agent, to my publisher. They are both of the opinion, for I think probably two completely opposite reasons, that it's not the time yet for that. But I do have those, that sort of plot outline is there in the back of my head. So when my publisher decides that it's time to pull the trigger on that, I'm ready to go.
Yeah, that's great that you've thought it through. What is Mal Goes to War about?
Mal Goes to War is set in more of a near future setting here on Earth. It takes place, give or take, around 2065. The basic premise there is that we've reached a future state where it's possible to sort of biologically or mechanically augment yourself. People are doing genetic manipulations to make their children bigger, stronger, faster, smarter. They're using hardware implants in their brains to do various things, to download porn, among other things, sort of fully immersive. The main character, Mal, is artificial intelligence, who's sort of loose in the networks of this world, kind of observing a war between two factions of humans, one of whom is represented by the federal government, is sort of dedicated to the accelerating changing of humanity, and the other, which is more of sort of a fundamentalist religious sect that believes that all these augmentations of humans are morally evil, primarily because they're only available to the rich.
Yeah.
And so the poor are basically being left behind. Mal, at the outset of the book, really has no dog in this fight. He's just sort of hoping that humans don't destroy the infrastructure that he relies on to survive. But he winds up getting trapped inside the body of a cyborg mercenary who had been tasked with protecting a little girl. And he sort of takes on that role very reluctantly. And it's a book about found family to a certain extent, because as they travel through this sort of war-torn area, they accumulate a group of friends around themselves. And really, they're just trying to get out of the war zone. They're trying to get to a place of safety, and that becomes increasingly impossible to do as the book goes on.
It's amazing. It sounds great. Thank you so much.
I gotta make sure I say this is a dark comedy. I just made it sound extremely grim, and there are grim parts to it, but it does have a lot of humor in it too. There is some lightness.
Yeah, and of course I really admired the humor of Mickey Seven. It was great to have it all all coming together. I must say I'm really I don't want to give too much away, but what's on this planet is really interesting. The creatures of this planet and what I've imagined in my head, I'm very interested to see what they look like in imagination.
We do go into the creepers a lot more in Antimatter Blues. So if you're interested, guys, you might want to pick that one up.
Okay. No, I'm very excited. Have you had any relationship with South Africa? I'm just curious. Johannesburg?
I have not spent any time in South Africa now.
Okay.
That's one of those places that's on my list of places to see in the world, but I haven't made it there yet.
Okay. Well, just know that in the heart of Johannesburg, yeah, we're the Bioscopes and Independent Cinema. We're a space here for you. I'm the owner, so I'm around. But hopefully we can keep in touch. If you ever do have a trip to South Africa planned, it would be lovely to meet you.
I appreciate that. I will keep that very much in mind.
We use the Bioscope for the occasional book launch because it's just big enough to be a crowd. We've got 47 seats here. And it's a venue that obviously has all the seats facing in the one direction, as you would for a cinema. Mm-hmm. So you've got a nice captive audience for people to actually listen to you if you're like, for example, a singer-songwriter doing something a bit more quiet. You'd be lost at a bar where everyone's sitting at tables. Same with comedy. There's a focus to the stage. And so it works really well for book launches. So it could be lovely to, a boy can dream, but have you perhaps one day do a reading or something? It would be lovely.
Well, I appreciate it. I will bear that in mind. Like I said, if I ever make it down to that part of the world, I will definitely look you up.
I have one last question for you, which is in your bio and your website, you speak of your one dog, and then you said you also got a purebred rat tantula. What is that?
Yeah, that's
I'd imagine it's a little yappy dog. Am I correct?
She's about 25 pounds. She's not that little. People always ask you, well, what breed is your dog? What kind of, we get rescue dogs. I'm not interested in getting purebred dogs. And this particular dog is unique in her appearance. And so that whenever anyone asks me sort of what is she? Yeah. Like she's half rat, half tarantula, which is sort of what she looks like. She's a fierce protector of the house. She guards us from all the squirrels and raccoons, keeps them all at bay. So we're very grateful to have her.
Our rescue dogs in South Africa that have become a breed on their own, and the breed is referred to as an Afrikaner, which is this mix of everything. they're relatively sort of medium size. They're very strong. They'll outlive all your other dogs. And I think they refer to as Afrikaners, which is interesting.
Well, those are always, mixed breeds are all the healthiest dogs.
Yeah.
Inbreeding is not good for any species, and that's true for us and for dogs and for everybody else. So the more sort of variety you can get in your genetic background, the better off you're going to be.
Good old Darwinism. What is it that you lecture, and where do you lecture?
I'm a cancer researcher by trade, so that's what I do for my day job. I also I teach quantum physics, just one sort of lecture series per year at the University of Rochester. It's more or less a favor that I do for my old PhD advisor there. He's not, I think, super comfortable with that particular topic, and so he lets me step in and cover his courses in that space, and it's. I like working with students. I feel like I'm sort of a natural teacher, and so it's something I do just sort of to keep my teeth sharp in the teaching area, in the lecturing area.
I'd imagine that lecturing does play a huge part, particularly with writing and teaching, especially when you're trying to teach us about this particular place we're at in this far future world. You know, you have to explain it. You have to outline it.
Skills. Yeah, they're complementary skills, and I, you know, obviously my books are not physics tests. I'm not trying to teach anyone any kind of principles of quantum physics. But again, I think it is helpful to have that background knowledge, so when I do throw out a detail here or there, it's actually accurate. It's actually true.
Yeah,
I think that's a helpful thing to be able to do.
Lovely. Well, Edward, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate you making the time, and I'm very excited for you how the next 6 months will play out and when the film was released. Do you know why it did get that delay? What was it that they needed to change? Do you know?
Yeah, no, this was all due to the writer's strike that occurred last year. So Dune Part 2 was supposed to be released in November.
Yeah.
But because of the writer's strike, they pushed that to March. That's also a Warner Brothers property. Mm. So they were not going to release two big budget science fiction epics within 2 weeks of each other. That would have, you know, cannibalized each other's audiences.
Yeah.
And so as a result, this film was going to get pushed. Did, Mickey 17 was going to get pushed. What happened.
Did they need more time to finish things? Or was it more of a timing thing? Do you know?
I'm sure that probably factored into it as well. Director Bong is, you know, he's a perfectionist and an artist. He tries to balance every single frame of his films like a painting. I mean, when I was watching him film, I watched them probably a 5-minute sequence in the film. They spent 8 hours going just over and over and over this, refilming it from different angles and having, you know, it was a close-up scene and having the performer sort of lift your elbow by a few centimeters, drop your right hand by a centimeter or two, because he wanted the frame, just that individual frame, to be perfectly balanced. And so to do that level of detailed work, it takes time. My understanding is that, you know, director Bong filmed something like 500 hours of film for every hour that actually winds up on the screen. My understanding is that's a much higher ratio than most directors work with. Mm. And as a result, he's got a lot to sort through to piece together exactly what he wants to have up on the screen. And so I'm sure there that probably is a factor in it too.
Yeah. Sure. Well, I'm so excited for you. I'm so excited for the film. It'll be the kind of film that I think would do very well at the Bioscope. And so it's going to be exciting to see it. I've been... been more of a film watcher than a reader, and so there's been very few films where I've been able to have imagined it first in my head before seeing the film, and this is going to be one of the few where I've been been able to read the book first, and so I'm very excited for it to come out.
I hope you have fun with it when it does show up.
Yeah, thank you so much, and thank you for your time, and all the best with everything.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate it. Again, I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you. And, you know, hopefully we get a chance to speak again when they make my next book into a movie as well.
Fantastic. Lovely. Thank you for your time, hey.
Okay, great. Right. Have a good day.
You too. Cheers, eh? All right.
Mm.
What a great dude. Very smart dude.
Yeah. Yes.
I must say, this was the start of me reaching out to more strangers.
Okay.
And sort of more higher profile people.
Yes.
Over the last few years at the video store, a lot of these people, even if they're super established in South Africa, there's a friendliness and there's a rapport that I have with them.
Yes.
A lot of them have been friends I've been lucky enough to make over the years.
Mm-hmm.
But this was this was a lovely lesson in interviewing, where I came in with a lot of wide-eyed sort of naivety about, oh my God, like, your life is going to change. And he was like very methodical.
Yes.
And quite serious, but he spoke so well, and he really carried the interview.
Yeah.
And so I really appreciate Edward for that. And I appreciate his time once again. I also, in all my excitement, never found him something to rent, which is, you know, this is as I said, the interviews have certainly evolved, and I've certainly tried as the interviewer to stick to certain things that make our interviews unique, one of which is me trying to get this person to leave with a film off the shelf.
Yes.
And so I thought it'd be worth mentioning that in the emails afterwards I said, listen, have you seen the movie District 9.
Okay.
And it was based on this short, and I sort of spoke about it, and I was like, that is something that I think you would enjoy.
Okay.
This kind of somewhat dystopian,
yes.
Even though it's just Joburg. But just a refreshing, interesting, indie way of doing sci-fi.
Okay.
I always get confused. District 6 is the real place in Cape Town.
Yes.
District 9 is the movie.
Yes.
And I was like, I would rent you this because okay. I think it's worth you also learning a little bit more about me and
yes.
Joburg in South Africa.
Yeah.
And if you haven't seen it, I think you'd appreciate it. So,
cool.
So without it being literally part of the interview, I rented him District 9.
There you go.
Oh, I see we've got another customer here.
Oh, cool.
We've got Stefan. Let's see what he is returning.
How's it? I'm Stefan, and I'm returning Mickey 17. What a movie. I remember when my friends invited me to watch it, I saw it, I heard about the cast and the director, and I was super excited about it. And I read up, and one of the things said it's an irrelevant, hilarious sci-fi movie, which I was like, okay, cool, let's watch it. And I was excited to see what Robert Pattinson could do with this character, especially when they said a bit of a comedy, drama comedy in it. So I was excited to see that. And he really did impress. The cinematography of the whole movie was fantastic. And those awesome creatures there in space and all of that. It's just hilarious. And it was good to see how the whole cast did. And I was very, very excited what Bong Joon-ho managed to do with referencing one of those more famous politicians at the moment. And I felt like it wasn't really that subtle, but it was brilliant the way Mark Ruffalo also played that role. So fantastic movie, definitely worth a watch, especially if you want to just go see a movie in the theater with some mates, have some popcorn, have a drink with it as well. But definitely worth it. Shot for the recommendation.
Okay, well, that makes sense.
Yeah.
He rented Mickey 17 this weekend. It's nice that he enjoyed it. What did you think of it, G-Force?
It's interesting. It's we use the term big swing around here a lot.
Yeah, you're one for that.
Yes.
We all have our things. Each one of us who works behind the counter here at the video store, G-Force, you like the big swing.
I like a big swing. This is definitely a big swing.
Especially
for a like something like a $120 million studio movie to make something this weird.
Yeah, I must say I left with the same feeling. So I wish I actually could have joined you guys again.
Yes,
because I felt that I needed to watch it again.
Yeah, you saw it before us.
Yeah, I went to an exhibitor screening as the owner of the Bioscope. And so those are also quite tough because it's just me and like the new Metro people
okay.
or like just me and the Sterkinigal people in yes. this big cinema, like just five or six of us.
Right.
Where you don't get the sense of like, you know, do the people find that funny?
Mm.
Is that moment a gasp moment or whatever? So and sometimes it also at odd times. Like I watched The Monkey way too early. It was like at fucking 9 a.m.
It's not a 9 o'clock in the morning movie.
It is certainly not. So it is quite hard to get a read. But I left that going, wow, that was an odd movie.
Yeah.
Like, delightfully odd. It, like, stuck with me, but it was odd.
Yes.
And so the way I've seen it is that, you know, we have been exposed to so much more Korean stuff through Netflix.
Oh,
especially,
yes.
Especially, like, okay. The Squid Games. And I have an interesting question to you, which is, do you think an American would ever make a Squid Games?
Ooh.
And could they ever make it in the same way? It just feels like sometimes with that Japanese, Korean
yeah.
sort of just, you know, where you just have other religions at play, you have other principles at play, you
yeah.
have other ways of looking at the world.
Yeah.
That what's so exciting is that you make this delightfully different content.
Yeah.
And the book Mickey 7, you know, that Edward wrote, was quite straight-laced, quite methodical, quite scientific.
Yeah.
Which I loved about it. It was mostly about the fact that there are these rations on this ship.
A lot
on
of
this
it,
planet.
Yes, yeah.
And that now that there's two of them that they have to keep secret, how they like...
How they not actually
getting,
survive.
How they
yeah.
not getting enough food as
yes.
a result. Like, that's the majority of this.
Yeah, a lot of it is.
This book. Where
the practicality.
Bong Joon-ho's adaptation, he takes the marshal.
Yeah.
who in the book is just that much more of a sort of straight-laced general, run-of-the-mill general somewhat. Well, no kind of hugely defining personality. And he makes it this over-the-top eccentric, sort of almost Trump-like character.
Oh, 100%.
100% Trump.
Yeah.
But what I find interesting is that Trump hadn't done his second term yet.
Yeah.
You know, this was done years ago, so it was interesting that it was almost like a post-Trump thought as opposed to what really is now an actual current Trump thought. But the movie itself has just got this like weirdness to it.
Mm.
It's odd.
It is unusual. I think...
So just to close off my point, is that I think this movie is perfect for the kinds of audiences that have been enjoying the weirder, darker, more sort of off-center Korean content.
Okay.
Like, I think this is perfect for them.
All right.
I think if you're coming for... Because when I've described this to people in the lobby and I've said, oh, he's this expendable and they can clone him.
Yeah.
It's like... It sounds like a sort of John Cena movie. It sounds it sounds like quite a silly sort of action movie.
Yeah.
But when you watch it, when you actually watch Mickey 17, it's got this like weird fucked upness to it, which is wild for a big studio film.
Yeah.
Sorry. So now your points.
What was I going to say? I think it's definitely a chunk of it is mostly the same story, but very much filtered through Bong Joon-ho because all of his stuff is very satirical.
Yeah.
There's always like a social and political commentary matter to it.
Yeah.
Which the book doesn't really do that much.
Mm.
Like it's not focused on that, but this is like he's taken that story and made it about that.
Yeah.
In a completely not subtle way. But his stuff has never been subtle. Like his metaphors and his satire are not subtle in any of his movies.
Yeah.
But this one for me kind of lacked a bit of the nuance that he usually has.
Okay.
Like this was so broad and so kind of distracted by its pastiche of Donald Trump and like MAGA era America.
Yeah, it did distract a bit from that.
You know, that I found like it was lacking in like its characterization. Like all of Mickey 17's character comes from Robert Pattinson.
Yeah,
not really from the writing.
He does a great job.
He does a really good job in this of like playing different, because I think we still have that thing in our head of Robert Pattinson is the Twilight guy.
Yeah.
It's very hard to get away from that.
Sure.
But he does a good job of playing it differently and also differentiating 17 and 18 really well. They're very, very different characters.
Yeah.
Which it doesn't really explain why they're so different from each other when they're clones.
Yeah.
Like I wish that like we got something of like, okay, why are these guys, why is one this meek, like pathetic little man, and the other one's a complete fucking psychopath.
Yeah.
Like,
no, sure, that's a good point.
Yeah.
In theory, they're the same.
Person. Like, I feel like you could explain that, but they were just like, no, we're doing like the satire. We're not worried about the sci-fi side of it.
Yeah.
The sci-fi side of it is just like the canvas. We're like using that to do our political satire.
Sure, because I feel like in the book, They did feel like the same people.
They felt a lot more similar. Like you could tell the one was like older and a bit more worn down, and the other one was a bit, he's new and he's a bit more assertive.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, you got a bit of that.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the bigger differences. We'll talk about this more when we go outside.
Yeah.
I think the characters are very different in the book.
I think for those who've come this far and don't actually know the plot, because I don't think, I was a bit afraid to reveal it in the chat, but basically in this colonized planet where Mickey is this expendable that can be duplicated when he dies. He is assumed to be dead.
Yes.
And so they make the next incarnation of him, but he happens to survive.
Yeah.
And gets back to the base and discovers there's now two of them.
Yes.
So sorry, that is a rather important part, but you get it in the trailers. But I'm just tying all the dots together because the movie is then about these two folks who shouldn't be alive together. In this world, when you've got multiples, that's a complete abomination, and all of them should die.
Yes, like partially just because of resources, but also they go into this a little bit more in the book. There's like a religious, like sect that's very, very against multiples.
Yeah,
like,
there's this sort of ethical dilemma there.
Yeah,
and they know how bad it is that that there are two of them,
yeah,
and one of them, in theory, should die. They can't figure out who to kill.
Yes.
Or how. None of them want to die.
Obviously.
And then that's the sort of the crux of the movie.
Yes.
But as you said, you're right. When I think of the... Well, that's the crux of the story.
Mm-hmm.
The movie, when I think about it, you're right. It does get overshadowed by all the fanfare.
Mm. By its own satire.
And all these sort of larger-than-life characters. Yeah. It's amazing how much that Marshall character actually does dominate the movie.
Yes.
But I loved seeing the creepers.
Yes, and they look great.
And that was one of those rare moments, and I've spoken about it at the video store, that I haven't been that person who read a lot of the books before the movies.
Yes.
And so I was very excited, for those who've been listening over the years, when Dune came out. That was like a novel thing for me. And then this was this rare case where I was like, oh my God, the movie's delayed, but the book's here.
Yes.
I get to do this. And this is the first time... really, that I can imagine or remember, where I, you know, was imagining this whole thing in my head before watching the movie. So I did actually imagine the creepers in the exact same way.
Yeah, I think the book, they managed to follow that description quite well.
Yeah, and then of course there's this sort of interactions with them at the end. But I think we'll get into that in the alleyway.
Yes.
But yeah, I think. Yeah, it's odd. Yeah. It's just delightfully odd.
I do think you should watch it. I think it's going to be a divisive movie for all the reasons that we've been speaking about. But I do think you should watch it to make up your own mind about it. Because I've been seeing a lot of like varying reactions to it online.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, should we just chat about one or two other things?
Let's do it.
Okay, but just before we go out into the alley, I watched quite a lot of cool stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I think maybe in like next week's episode, we can unpack them more and we can chat more about them.
Alrighty.
Or I can just be bringing them up as we go.
Yes.
But I finally watched It Ends With Us.
Oh, right.
Which is the sort of the, you know...
Yes, a movie that's been overshadowed by...
Yeah.
All the nonsense around it.
There's been a lot of nonsense. And to be honest, I don't even understand or have paid attention to what the nonsense is. But it is a good movie. It's it's on Netflix. I think it... What's that?
I just said, I didn't know it was on Netflix. Yeah.
Okay. It's a story of romance. It's effectively a study of the subtlety of abuse.
Okay.
I think we've watched a lot of movies or we get subject to a lot where... you know, that abuse is very obvious and very real and very tangible.
Yeah.
I think this is a lovely commentary on how subtle sometimes abuse can be.
Okay.
And how even the smallest act
right.
can have its consequences. I found it interesting that later in the same weekend, we watched She Said.
Okay.
Which is also on Netflix, which is the reporters. It's a film. Biopic about the reporters at the New York Times that built the initial big article or announcement of Harvey Weinstein.
Okay. I didn't know there was already a movie about that.
Yeah, yeah. It's quite a film. And it also just shows this case building. It shows the ethics of journalism. It shows the care and the thought and the legalities of how one puts these things together, the time that it took.
Right.
Another film that it's a four-part series also on Netflix called Toxic Town, which is also funny enough. They're all these kind of like everything that we watched all was a little bit interlinked, but this was also about a sort of a case-building story. And it was about a town in the UK that was a factory town and based on how the town council got rid of the waste of this factory, a whole bunch of women at a certain period were giving birth to babies that had birth defects.
Okay.
And this miniseries is all about, or limited series, is all about the case that they had against the council, which took years, like 10, 12 years to build, to prove that... you know, how the dust was in the air and how that could have affected them. And it's a good film. I saw it as a film, even though it was a limited series. It had the woman, Jodie, who was the doctor, she was Doctor Who. She was the female Doctor Who.
Oh, I know who you're talking about.
I'll tell you right now.
I can't remember her name.
Jodie Whittaker.
Okay.
And it also stars Amy Lou Wood,
okay.
who is the woman, one of the students in Sex Education, the right. one with the buck teeth.
Okay.
Which is such a defining character of her as right. an actress.
Yes.
It's so cool that she's a fucking incredible actress, but she's the most sort of anti, you know, typical
yes.
actress, because she's got these like funny buck teeth.
Right.
But you can imagine her having a real complex about it.
Yes.
And thinking that would stop her from getting roles. Yeah. But
here she is
yeah. doing so well. I also watched the Blackberry biopic.
Oh, okay.
Which is definitely worth your time.
Okay. Cole didn't like it.
Okay.
I remember Cole saying he didn't like it.
Just, I wonder where Cole was with Blackberry, because I used Blackberry.
Okay.
The first 2 years of the Bioscope was built on Blackberry, because we had them.
Yes.
And myself and the guy I started the Bioscope with, Daryl, we each had a Blackberry. It enabled us to communicate and answer emails and go right. on Facebook.
Yes.
For the first time ever. It was like, it was a crazy time. And then just fucking plummeted and disappeared. So this is a biopic about the rise and the fall of it.
Okay.
And it stars one of the douchebags from Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
Oh, right.
The one that's like the sort of pretty boy guy. Glenn Howerton.
Okay.
And he's got this like sort of weird sort of bald patch in this movie.
Right.
I must say, the wigs in the movie weren't the best, but they did the job. Jay Baruchel.
Okay.
Is one of the founders of BlackBerry.
Right.
I enjoyed it.
Okay, that's good.
I'm
so cynical about these products as movies, things that have become such a trend lately.
Mm.
Ugh.
I really enjoyed the Tetris.
Oh, right.
I thought that was a great one.
Okay.
You know, 'cause it was just so fascinating.
Right.
This is about hubris, you know, fucking stock market fraud and,
right.
you know, go, go, go.
Yes.
But Tetris is special. That's over on Apple TV.
Okay.
Apple TV Plus, I believe.
Okay.
'Cause that involves, like, the Iron Curtain, the
yeah,
Cold War.
Yeah, it was made in Russia.
No. Tetris is special. BlackBerry, okay. This is like, if you're a bit more of a sort of finance-minded person,
yeah.
or business or entrepreneurial, you might find this the BlackBerry film interesting. And also, if you were around for it,
yes.
I think you'd remember that time and remember that moment when BlackBerry just dominated.
Mm.
It was the same as like MySpace.
Yes.
You would have never thought that at that point that they would just completely disappear.
Yeah.
You'd think that they were un-fucking touchable.
Yeah.
Because they were just so dominant.
Yeah. And then along came the iPhone.
And then they just got fucked up.
Yeah, they just couldn't keep up.
It's wild. All right. I think we've had ourselves a long, beautiful day here.
All right.
But let's lock up.
Yes.
As we said, and then let's go back into the alleyway
mm-hmm.
where we can talk a little bit more about Mickey 7 and Mickey 17.
Yes.
All right. Thank you for listening, everyone.
Definitely.
And we want to see you guys back next week.
Yeah.
There's lots of cool stuff to still chat about. I didn't even touch on The Great Lillian Hall,
okay.
which is a film that's in cinemas at the moment.
All right.
Yeah, there's a lot, but we'll get into it in more greater detail next week.
Cool.
When there's more of us behind the counter. But yeah, home base is thevideostore.co.za. And let us know what you think about Mickey 17.
Yes,
as
please.
We said, we've got our words, but we also don't quite know how to articulate
yes.
it. So if you've got thoughts and opinions, put them in. If you've read the book,
yeah,
let us know as well. And yeah, hope to see you again next week.
Definitely.
Okay. Bye bye.
Bye.
All right.
Yes.
No one's listening. It's just you and me. Let's talk about the differences at the end.
Okay.
Okay, because I find it interesting that they sort of had the same principle, but they were different.
Yes.
Okay, so just remind me, in the book, there's bombs.
Yes. So from the point where they get discovered, basically, that there are multiples.
Yes.
It completely changes from that point.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The book and the movie, like, deviate quite a lot.
Yeah.
In the book, essentially, all that stuff happens. They're discovered. Typically, they'd be destroyed, but they're going, wait, let's just use these things that were the way we're supposed to use expendables.
Yeah.
So they're given antimatter bombs, both Mickey 7 and Mickey 8, to go and destroy the aliens, the alien worm creatures.
Creepers.
Yes,
yeah.
The creepers. So that's what happens in the book.
Yeah, and then he's able to communicate with them.
Yes.
And he communicates differently, hey?
They communicate like telepathically almost. Like,
yeah.
Like it's all in the mind. It's not... In the movie, he has a little like translator thing.
Yeah, which is cool.
Yeah, I think that's okay.
Yeah.
It's a little less direct.
And then what happens again? What's the difference?
In what way? There's so many differences at this point.
Yeah. he then comes to appreciate and respect the creepers and doesn't want to kill them.
Yeah, well, he realizes that they're actually like thinking sentient things. They're not just
sort of
worms.
Just worms, yeah.
That are in the book, they're like a collective consciousness. Which is why they don't understand. So they've been like taking people, like people have been disappearing.
Mm.
But in the book, they don't understand the concept of the individual because they're all just like a collective mind. They're all one thing.
Mm.
So they don't see like just taking one person to them isn't important, which is completely different in the movie because in the movie, they have a baby creeper and they're freaking out because they specifically want this baby creeper back.
Yeah, because they are this kind of collective. They know what's happening. It's like they can feel
yes,
what's
that's,
happening.
They know that it's in peril. But in the context of the book, they wouldn't see that as an individual who matters.
Yeah.
Because they're all just like one conscious, like they're one thing.
Yeah.
That's why they've been taking people and those people have been dying and they don't understand why that's a bad thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And then Mickey has to explain that, etc. But yeah, that's where it deviates. One of the many ways the second half in particular deviates.
And then, then the book, I don't know, I actually don't even think we want to give it away, but... But it's a similar idea that he sort of avoids the blowing up of these bombs.
Yes.
And sort of tricks the base.
Yes.
In a sort of similar way.
Mm-hmm.
And it sort of ends in a sort of a somewhat similar way.
Kind of, yeah.
Oh, but the big differences in the movie is the fact, the reveal at the end.
Yes.
Of the fact that both... Mark Ruffalo and his wife's character have been multiplying themselves.
Yes.
have also been cloning themselves.
Yeah.
Why? That's also that
didn't really go anywhere. I don't know why, like what the point of that was.
Mm.
Like again, this is one of the reasons why I need to watch it again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
But another big difference is like all the characters are very different. Mickey 17 is, well, Mickey 7 isn't like, he's very put upon, but he's not like pathetic the way Mickey 17 is.
Yeah.
And Mickey 8 is like a bit assertive, but he's not a psychopath the way Mickey 18 is.
Mm.
And like his girlfriend as well, I can't remember the character's name.
Nasha.
She's Nasha. She's like a lunatic in the movie as well. But in the book, she's like much more level-headed. And then his friend character is the one played by Steven Yeun.
Yeah, Dino.
Also a totally different character as well. He's like a famous athlete. And the reason that all of this is happening isn't... In the movie, Steven Yeun's character convinced him to start a macaron store and they took out a loan. It's a really funny idea.
Macaron.
Yes.
Yeah, those little French biscuit things.
Yes.
And the
reason they're trying to get off the planet is because now they owe these like horrible people... these horrible criminals' money. But in the book, he bets his friend who used to be an athlete before leaving the planet, like plays the whatever sport he played one more time, and he bet against him like massive amounts of money.
Yeah, because
he thought he was going to lose.
Sports gambling.
Yes,
thing. That's
and
right.
He thought he was going to lose because he was convinced that this guy hasn't done it in 10 years. But instead, he like completely dominated.
Okay.
And he owes someone a ton of money.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's
why
he tries to get out of there.
So yeah, it's interesting. That's a good example of the differences. That it's the same sort of setup and principle, but just sort of done in a completely weird, odd way that they start a macaron company.
Yes. I like that. That's actually quite a good idea.
It's so weird. I definitely think we'd appreciate it on a second watch.
Yeah, I hope so.
It's got a little bit of a slow burnness to it.
Yeah.
All right. Is there anything else that we're sort of dying to sort of chat about or mention at this point.
Not without getting into like serious spoilers, which I don't really want to do at this point.
No.
We can see how like the response to it goes, and if we want to talk about it again,
yeah,
you know, we can always come back to it at some point.
Yeah. Okay, magic. Cool. But what a treat once again
to
have had Edward pop in.
Definitely.
And to have, yeah, to have gotten to know him.
Definitely.
So yeah, thank you for sticking around all this time.
Yeah.
We appreciate you. And we'll see you again next week.
Yes, yes.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.